Spearfish turns out to experience the simple joy of learning something new. From SDPB, today is Friday, June 20th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we connect with the campus of Black Hills State University to get to know community members and faculty members as they bring their research and life experiences forward. We'll begin with a small farm that brings vegetables to the table. We'll explore luminescence at the cellular level. We'll learn how visual art has marked shifts in the environment in stark ways. Shakespeare captures our attention with sonnets that turn and reveal. And we will ask what those baseball cards might be worth today if only your mom hadn't tossed them when she was cleaning the attic. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we are giving you a taste of the joy of learning spearfish style. It's an educational series happening now at Black Hills State University. The series is free. It's open to the public. We're going to begin this hour with a small vegetable farm that offered a community tour this week. Trish Jenkins and Jeremy Smith are the owners of Cycle Farm. They joined us from SDPB's Sue W. White Studio at Black Hills State.
We came to farming. Jeremy has a background in ecology and aquatic invertebrate study, and I studied surface water hydrology in school, and kind of so we both have this love for the environment and being outside, and we spent some time getting to know the local food system when we lived in northern New Mexico, mm-hmm. and seeing different parts of small-scale mixed vegetable growing and larger-scale big kind of CAFO dairy milk production. And we decided that what we really wanted to do was be in community, in community with our friends and neighbors through food and land stewardship. Mm. And Jeremy grew up in this part of South Dakota. So when we were looking for land, we were thinking, well, we appreciate the kind of the seasons and the spending a go time during the summer and having some rest time in the winter. Yeah. And so we thought, well, that this is a good latitude for us. And so it was.
Yeah, and I had family here still, and but neither of us grew up in agriculture at all. Mm-hmm. I grew up in spearfish, but would. I had a friend that lived across the street from where we currently live, so I would be on our street, but only to go get lunch during high school. So I knew nothing about ag.
Nothing.
But so we then learned while we were in New Mexico, kind of involved with some nonprofits doing land restoration and stream or like erosion control, mm-hmm. in kind of that brittle landscape, and working a lot with producers and working lands. And they had a big conference each year that we kind of were steeped philosophically in how we wanted to farm with no practical experience. So we came to the farm and just started making big mistakes, or little big mistakes on a little scale.
Uh-huh. So
the farm's just 3 acres total.
So what were some of those early mistakes that you really felt in retrospect, like, I had to allow myself to make that.
Mm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. There were some things where we are still limited by budget. So there were things where we kind of did things that we could afford. And then as the way it works, you kind of, those things become pattern and start calcifying, and then you're kind of, you forget why you made that decision in the first place. And so we're like, oh wait, we could change that.
Two years ago,
that's worth investing in.
Rearranged the farm entirely, its layout, and split our beds in half. We changed our irrigation system. Mm-hmm. We're just in the process of redoing our fencing. So kind of.
Yeah.
All the initial infrastructure we put in, we've found fault with.
So you're in conversation with the people who were there 3 years ago. That's you, or you know, you're in conversation with the previous seasons of yourself. I love that. Did most of the learning come from doing, from reading, from mentorship? How did you grow? How do you continue to grow and get better?
All of those things.
Yeah.
We have a really, really incredible community of local growers, small, like, there's not a whole lot of us, but we're like, I feel really lucky. We're very close, so that we've, I think, learned a lot from neighbor growers.
Yeah, but we also have a big stack of books. and right when we were starting, the like poetry and the other books get read more than the farming books, which is like obvious as you come down our driveway. Like these people don't actually know what they're doing, but there's lots of flowers.
Yeah, but it's pretty, yeah.
Yeah.
But you're creating a life that you want to live, and then also going back to what you said at the very beginning of our conversation, you're in community with the people around you. Mm-hmm. And that's not nothing.
No, it's everything.
Yeah.
What's the role of bicycles at Y Cycle Farm? Tell us a little bit about bikes as farm tools.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. So the name kind of right as we had bought the property. Neither of us were living in Spearfish at the moment. I was at a bicycle frame building apprenticeship program in Oregon, and Trish was still in New Mexico kind of finishing up her work there. We both love bicycles and bicycles for utilitarian purposes. So that kind of fit. And then the farm gets to be part of all these natural cycles. So the seasons, life and death, the water cycle, nutrient cycling, carbon cycling, plant life cycles, all those. Mm-hmm. And then where we happen to be in Spearfish is historically a lot of truck farms. And we borrow my dad's truck, but don't actually have our own. So we have a bicycle instead. So we have kind of three reasons for cycle farm.
We had intentions. This is kind of like we had intentions of setting up, and I think it's still kind of like lurking, is to do more kind of, Jeremy mentioned this apprenticeship program, to do more constructing specialized bike frames, cargo bikes, trailers, and also different like kind of garden hand tools during the winter months. Okay. And what we found is that the winter in South Dakota just isn't too long enough to get all the things done that we want to do. So we've kind of like tinkered with that, but haven't put as much energy into that as we.
Tell me a little bit about the farm share and your relationship with customers, Trish.
We offer a modified CSA share program to community members, and the CSA stands for
Community Supported Agriculture.
It's a kind of a pretty traditional marketing style for farms, where they open up shares in early in the spring, late winter. Community members invest in the farm, and then throughout the summer, the farmer puts together a basket of produce that's like ripe and ready from the field that week. And it works really well for the customers. They get the a wide variety of produce, what's in season, and it's local. They get to know their farmer and be involved in that direct kind of food system. It works for the farmer, and they get the literally the seed money that helps them buy seed, replace irrigation, kind of do the things that they are spending a lot of money on in the spring. It helps them with that kind of capital flow. Yeah. Ours is the kind of modified, I mentioned. So it's customers have a choice.
People basically have a credit at the farm stand.
Okay. So
we have an old farm stand that we were able to move to our property. Mm-hmm. That was built in the 40s. And then our customers just kind of come up to it and have a tally sheet and just have to use up their credit by the end of the season. Mm-hmm. And that allows us to not have to worry on our small scale about growing 35 cabbages that are all about the same size and at the same maturity each week, or like for that week, so that the shares are even. We can pick 8 cabbages this week and 24 the next week and 15 the week after, and it works. Our customers are able to not have to show up each week if they have busy summer schedules, or they can get twice as much if they have company visiting.
Right. You mentioned poetry. Do you have a favorite poetry? Do you have a favorite writer who is helping inform the work you do on the farm?
Ooh.
Wow. That's very...
Here we go. You want the list, Lori.
It's really quick to jump to Roske and his kind of connection and celebration of food and community.
Delight, and, Roske with,
Mary Oliver. There's a another neat farmer, grower, poet from Vermont, David Budbill, who's really neat.
That's Trish Jenkins and Jeremy Smith. They're the owners of Cycle Farm, which uses bikes as farm tools whenever possible. Now, if you found bicycles and vegetable farming a unique combination, just wait for this next Joy of Learning session preview. Yoon-seok Choi is an assistant professor at Black Hill State University. He presented this week on color and light and how they shape biology, mainly how luminescence in a cell impacts his potential cancer research. I also connected him from our studios at Black Hill State.
My session highlights how light creates color, influences our biology, and is used in modern scientific tools like biosensors. I shared real-life examples from nature, medicine, and even my own lab. We also did some fun hands-on activities like observing glowing proteins.
When I think of a biosensor, I think of a thermometer. Is that wrong? A very basic, like, what's a biosensor?
So biosensor is definitely detecting biomolecules. Mm-hmm. So when I explain biosensor, I use a smoke detector as an example.
Okay.
Smoke detector is detecting smoke. Biosensor detect specific biomolecule. So they detect. Smoke detector gives us signal. Loud noise, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, biosensor also produce signal for us to measure biomolecule concentration. I use a light. So both of them detect, target, and produce signal.
Okay.
And then biosensor detect biomolecule. That's main difference.
Okay. So as you do your research, do you have an application in mind, or is the research question itself the most important thing?
At the beginning of my research, I wanted to use my biosensor for biological study, mm-hmm. To understand biological mechanism. But recently, I wanted to use my biosensor for biomedical application. For example, my lab recently developed a NADH protein sensor. Mm-hmm. So NADH is closely related to cancer mechanism.
Okay.
So if we can detect NADH protein level in cell, then it can be a biomarker for certain disease.
Okay.
Including cancer. And then NADH, that protein is closely related to aggressive cancer mechanism.
So the
biosensor can be used to decide which drug candidate work well on treating aggressive cancer.
Okay, so NADH, NADH, is that...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Just for people who are listening, then what is light? I mean, how are you using light at a cellular level? I think of light outside that context.
For our audiences, uh-huh. I just want to start with very basic one. So the light we see in our environment, in our life, is a reflective light, right?
Okay.
So sunlight come to our earth and then for example, if you see red roses, the rose reflect light, red light, so that reflect the red light our lives on our eyes, and then we can see the red light. The biology, we use light, but a little bit different. Mm-hmm. We use fluorescence or luminescence. Mm-hmm. Fluorescence is subtype of luminescence. First, I want to explain luminescence. I think most people have experience playing with glow stick. Mm-hmm. Glow stick. If you break the glow stick, then we see beautiful color, right?
Yeah.
That's luminescent light.
Yeah.
That luminescent light is product of a chemical reaction.
Okay. It's not heat. It's just light.
Yeah. They emit a light as a product of a reaction.
Okay.
So my some of my sensor use luminescent light. So when it binds to its target, for example, when my sensor binds to NADH, so that's the first functions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Smoke detector binds to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
My sensor, NADH sensor binds to NADH. The second one is generating signal. Smoke detector produces loud noise. My sensor generates luminescence. So
yeah.
NADH binding to my sensor induce chemical reactions.
Ah.
And then generate luminescent light.
Ah, like a like yeah. a fungus, or like underwater where you see light in the darkness. So the chemical reaction is what's causing it for you.
Yeah, and also in our real life, firefly.
Okay, sure.
They generate light. That's luminescent light. The chemical reaction is happening inside the firefly.
So that's fascinating to me. Has that been done before? Are you working on building on someone else's research, or is this?
Oh, that's 100% done in our BHSU biosensor lab.
Okay.
And then I always appreciate our excellent students.
Yeah.
They heavily involved in this research and made it work.
In the future, this could help detect aggressive cancers at a cellular level. Do I understand that?
So we've finished the first stage.
Uh-huh.
The first stage is we showed it is working.
Mm-hmm.
We are currently working on second stage. Second stage is improving this sensor.
Okay.
The smoke detector, you know, they produce loud noise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Upon smoke. But if the sound is not loud, that's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that, my sensor also produce big signal upon target binding. So the second stage is we want to generate a big signal change.
Yeah.
So no target, less signal upon target binding, much bigger signal.
Yeah.
And then we can screen which drug work better. Right now we are improving the sensor
yeah.
function.
So for the Joy of Learning presentation, I know the
yeah.
last time we talked, Dr. Choi, you were using pop beads to help people understand, like those little plastic beads to help them understand DNA sequencing.
Yeah.
How do you have a hands-on activity that helps visitors to the Joy of Learning presentation understand light in biology?
So my lab prepared luminescent protein.
Oh.
So for example, cool. you know, the firefly specific protein is responsible for making light.
Yeah.
So we prepared proteins from deep sea shrimp. Deep sea shrimp also makes luminescent light
yeah.
to scare their predator.
Okay, yeah.
The reason why we didn't use firefly protein was the deep sea shrimp proteins make a brighter light.
Okay, yeah.
So in my lab, we prepared the deep sea shrimp proteins responsible for light generation. We took that proteins into the Joy of Learning session. And then people add chemical to induce reaction with the deep sea shrimp proteins, and then they saw the light. Was really fun activity.
Yoon-seok Choi is assistant professor at Black Hill State University. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. One is a painting of a skeletal cow watching wolves approach it in the snow. The other is a farmscape from the Dust Bowl. The cow in that painting is stalked by a vulture perched nearby. The next Joy of Learning session we're going to explore talks about what these paintings have to say about the U.S. environmental movements. John Kilpinen is a professor of geography at Black Hill State University. I connected with him via Zoom ahead of his Joy of Learning presentation next week.
I was reading some work by a historian named Finis Dunaway, who has worked with his students to really try to bring attention to images into environmental history. And part of what he's advocated for is for environmental historians and historical geographers to move beyond just using images to kind of highlight or illustrate, using them as illustrations. Can they be evidence to really examine for what's going on? And I think principally that focus has been on photographs, that if you think about photography, particularly in the American settlement context, after the Civil War, photography just started to appear on the scene. It was actually during the Civil War that some of the first photographs were taken and published in newspapers to account for, you know, certain battles and just the atrocities of the Civil War. But as settlement started to turn west, then photographers started to go west and started to document these new places that people hadn't seen before, places like Yellowstone National Park now and Grand Canyon. They heard fantastic stories, but they had never seen images of these places. Well, now photography allowed that to happen. So I think part of the focus has been on photographs as showing the moment of kind of discovery, for lack of a better term, in a place like the Black Hills or the Rocky Mountains. But increasingly, there were also artists who were out west who were able to capture things. And I think the difference between a photograph, which is a still frame, captures one moment in time, artists have an ability to pull threads from multiple scenes that they have observed. Even if you're trying to paint something relatively realistic, you're still, oh, I saw this thing over here, and so I'm going to put that in, and I'm going to put this over here. And the whole picture then pulls something together that's more than a single snapshot in time. A shutter click can only grab that fraction of a second, whereas a photographer or an artist's vision can pull in multiple things. And I think I wanted to take the approach that Dunaway was talking about and see if you could apply that to paintings, to artistic images. So can we examine them for a little bit more than just an illustration? Can they really tell us more than we might know?
Tell us about the two paintings that you're focusing on in your Joy of Learning presentation, because there are some similarities between them.
Yeah. So the first one that I've looked at, it's one that I've used in class for a number of years, and it's Charlie Russell's Waiting for a Chinook. And so for folks from the eastern part of the state who may not know what a Chinook is, it's a warming wind that comes down out of the mountains and in certain cases has produced record temperature changes in the positive direction. And so in the wintertime, a Chinook wind is welcome because it will warm the temperatures, melt the snow, maybe give you a little reprieve from that cold weather that we associate on the northern plains in the winter. And in Russell's case, he painted a painting called Waiting for a Chinook that depicts a single starving, emaciated steer surrounded by some wolves. And it was meant really as a report that he sent to some stock owners that he knew in Helena during The winter of 1986, 1987, 1886, 1887, which was just a devastatingly brutal winter on the Northern Plains. And so this set of investors that he knew in Helena had a herd of 5,000 cattle. And they knew the weather was bad. They hadn't had reports in a while. So they contacted him and said, "What's going on with our investment? What's going on with our herd?" And rather than write some letter, he just on a piece of cardboard or a napkin or something, I forget which, painted, "This is what you got left. It's not looking good." And so it really signaled at that moment, I think, beyond just capturing that particular episode for those investors, what Russell captured was the end of an entire economic era. After the Civil War, there had been this explosion of cattle ranching in the Northern Plains, bringing Texas cattle to Montana, the Dakotas, Wyoming, fattening them up and then shipping them east as immigration was starting up again after the Civil War. Northern cities were booming, food was needed, and people made a lot of money doing that. But the system that they were operating, this open range system for these cattle, was not suited to the Northern Plains in all but really mild winters. And that's what they had the first few years. Yeah. So then when this episode set in, it just obliterates herd after herd after herd. And so Russell, while responding to that one request, captures the end of this entire window of economic activity. It starts to change after this. Ranches become fenced. They change out the herd. They don't use Texas Longhorns anymore. They go with Herefords and Angus cattle, you know, breeds that produce well but need more attention. And so they also raised hay to feed them through the winter. So it was a completely transformative winter that he captured the end of in this one brilliant, stark, disturbing scene. Image, I've got a framed print of Waiting for a Chinook that I had on my wall for a long time. And it really freaked out one of my colleagues who thought it was just too grim.
It's pretty grim.
It is pretty grim.
And and the second image is also of an emaciated animal. And this one is a Dust Bowl era image.
So,
tell me
so
about
50
that.
Years later, similar setting, maybe not Northern Plains, a little more Southern Plains, more Oklahoma and Kansas. But about 50 years later, the bison are gone. Open range cattle is gone. After World War I, there's a major, major boom in wheat prices. And so farmers start to try to grow as much wheat as they can because it's really, really valuable. So they start to expand wheat farming on the Great Plains. They're aided by the appearance of tractors. We take tractors for granted, but they had to be invented and appear affordable at some point for individual farmers. And so they start to become available. So wheat farming expands, but also, like the open range cattle ranching phase, wheat farming is expanding at a time when the plains are generally a bit wetter than normal. So they have this impression that this is just going to go on forever. And so they expand their wheat farms. And then the 1930s hit and the rain stops. It just stops. But all of these farms now, all this native grassland has been plowed up to grow wheat. The soil is not being held. The wind picks up and these massive dust storms. There's another haunting picture, in this case, a photograph. There's a photograph of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., 1934, 1935, when one of these dust storms reaches all the way to Virginia. And this cloud over the monument just looks creepy. It looks like pollution, but it's dust. It's not small.
Topsoil.
Billions of tons of topsoil were lost. But another artist kind of captures this moment. Alexander Hoag, who was an artist, I think he was born in Missouri, but his family had moved to Texas, and then they owned property in the northwest corner of the Texas Panhandle. So he knew that area well, and he would go to visit relatives, and it was not going swimmingly at all. Farms were foreclosing, people were leaving. You had the whole Grapes of Wrath. John Steinbeck tapped into this, the people fleeing to go to California to try to find work. coupled with the economic impacts of the Great Depression. But the environmental factors were that this attempt at just growing unirrigated wheat, acre after acre after acre on the Great Plains, you can't do that, not in this dry period. And so it really came to a head. And Hogue painted a whole series, what were called the Erosion Series of paintings. But this one that I'm fascinated by is called Drought-Stricken Area. And as you mentioned, it has a focus on a single cow looking for water in a holding tank, but it's just full of dust. Mm-hmm. The whole landscape just looks apocalyptic.
Right.
Instead of wolves now, which have largely been removed by hunting on the plains, you now have vultures. There's one vulture in the foreground and several circling in the air in the distance, waiting again for this solitary bovine animal to keel over, and then they would cash in and feed. So similar to the wolves in the Russell painting. But I think you just, I'm just struck, both of these in their own ways kind of capture the ends of these periods. So after the 1930s, irrigation becomes prominent on the Great Plains. They start pumping water from the Ogallala Aquifer and other sources underground. They rotate crops much more carefully. They plow differently. They practice deeper soil conservation, all so that they cannot experience this again. And so just 20 years later in the 1950s, there's another big drought, but it's not nearly, even though the drought may have been worse, the effects weren't as bad because people were finally paying attention. But Hogue captured the reasons for the need for that in drought-stricken area. And so I think those the parallels, each capturing a different land use that was phasing out yeah. to something new, but focused on a single animal that was just struggling. And more or less, while there's no people in either of the paintings, pretty much is telling us we got it wrong. We didn't listen to the signs. We got a little confident, maybe a little cocky, and we're, oh, this is going to go on forever. We're really interested in making lots of money, so we'll do what that takes. And we get little course corrections that come from time to time. So some sobering messages.
The messages of images like this today, speaking to us from history about land management, about practices, about climate change, about agriculture, industrial agriculture. Are there reasons to look back on some of this art and pay close attention to where we're at today and what we should be in tune to?
I would think so, because these are just two examples. I think right. if we look back and we even look at European art, there's all sorts of things. There's some famous paintings of people in the, 1700s, 1600s even, ice skating in the Netherlands on rivers, which no longer freeze. You can't do that. There's no point in the winter where you can ice skate outdoors in the Netherlands without some sort of an actual man-made, cooling ice rink like you'd see in a park in the winter in New York or something. It just doesn't get that cold. So there are these artistic images that show us that nature changes, climate changes over time. And sometimes we can lose track of that and in some cases make it worse by what we do. For instance, just plowing up native grasses and assuming that weed is going to go on forever when drought comes and we find out we were wrong. So I think there's lots of insights that we can gain from the past. That's the whole reason to study history. I think, the cliche is, well, you study history so that you're doomed to repeat it. I don't know that history repeats itself, but there are lessons that we learn the same way we learn in our lives from different experiences. And people tell you learn more from your mistakes than you do from your successes because they sting. They really hurt sometimes, but you get over them. And sometimes the sting goes away and you forget the lesson. We need to remember some of these lessons. And I think some of these images can help us do that if we pay attention to them.
That's John Kilpinen. You can attend his Joy of Learning session next Wednesday. It is on the intersection between American art and U.S. environmental history. Well, we are sticking with art and artistic interpretation with this next Joy of Learning preview. Amy Fuqua is Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Black Hills State. She joined me from SDPB's Sue W. White Studios on the campus to share how to fall in love with a certain type of poetry. We'll also talk with her here about the big picture of the Joy of Learning sessions.
When President Nichols was here, she wanted the campus full of activities in the summer. And I decided what I could contribute is something I wanted to do for my own selfish reasons, and that I would share my own reasons with the community, and that is simply the joy of learning something new. I especially wanted to find things, give people the opportunity to learn something new that they didn't even know they wanted to learn. So that's happened to me as I sit through all of these, and they're just so wonderful. You start to learn something, and then you want to know more and more about it. And I think once you're out of, you know, once you're an adult, it's wonderful to be surprised by the joy of learning something new.
Is there something that you have that you didn't know already that you're particularly excited about?
Let me think. I'll think about, this week I've learned so much. I learned from Paul Higbee, a local historian of Black Hills history, and he has quite a following, so there are lots of people there for his presentation. I really have always wanted to know more about Spearfish Creek, and now I know that its drop in altitude is 5 inches per 100 feet, and I like to nerd out with that kind of information. And then I wanted to know a little bit, and my background is American literature, so I'm not going to be able to get very much into the math of things, but I really wanted to know then how the water is channeled and how decisions are made for the engineering of the ditch that supplied all of this area with water when it was, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And I learned all about that. Every single sentence he said was something interesting.
Isn't that true? I love having
Paul. And that's just one example.
This is one example. All right. So you are talking, you are also presenting, and your presentation is on Shakespeare's sonnets.
Yes. So I have some things in my hopper that I'd be interested in presenting. And then if I have any holes in the schedule, I put myself in. So I put myself into two holes. And one was the Shakespeare, which I presented Tuesday. Okay. And I was interested in helping people just love the Shakespearean sonnets. And I asked, how many of you have read a Shakespearean sonnet after, let's say, college or even after high school? And almost no one said yes. And so it was just, it's about a little sonnet, a 14-line poem, and how you dig in and what Shakespeare is doing and why that's cool.
Yeah. All right. So let's spread some of that to the state far and wide.
Exactly.
Because everybody here is raising their hands if they have or have not read a Shakespeare
sonnet.
Now, he did not invent this form, but why is his contribution to the sonnet so impactful even today?
Well, for one, it's in English, and so if you really want to go to the origin of sonnets, you're going to have to learn some Italian, and that'll slow you down a little bit.
Okay.
But the Renaissance or the early modern period of literature is really where we get people being introspective and thinking about their own thoughts and feelings and how those are created. And that really does speak to the 21st century mind. Sometimes you can just be jettisoned right from 1609 right into 2025 when you read Shakespeare's sonnets.
Most people know a few famous ones. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day, for example? Help us understand what the form is. 14 lines?
It's 14 lines. It has a rhyme scheme, so the end syllables of those 14 lines will rhyme with each other. Shakespeare usually has, well, I don't know if your listeners want to hear the code for it, but it ends in a rhyming.
We do.
Okay,
Public radio is educational, Amy.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, thank you for saying that. Okay, the rhyme scheme is usually A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. So that means there are seven rhymes. Rhymes. Now in Italian, since you're encouraging me to allow us all to nerd out a little bit, there'll be only 5 rhymes, and that's really because Italian has lots more rhyming words. So one thing that is interesting is to see how sonnets have changed as the language changes, how you accommodate the language and the form. And Shakespeare uses those forms, and he'll introduce an idea. He'll delve more deeply into it. Then he might counter his own argument a bit. Okay. And then he'll give a conclusion that is probably not just a pat conclusion. So you have to really, you know, there's some delight in having worked in the poem and then finding out what the last thing is he has to say about it.
I feel like the sonnet is one of those things that if you study, it helps you appreciate form as an opportunity.
Yes, seeing how they play within the form, how they tweak the form just a little bit. So if he's going along with iambic pentameter, that's unaccented syllables followed by accented syllables, it'll be, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? And you can kind of tell that that rhythm is there. And then if he gets mad, he'll say, oh no. And that breaks the form a little bit. And that, it just, the sound enriches the thought-feeling combo that you're invited to experience.
What's the turn? You said sometimes he contradicts himself, and that's fairly common, right? That there's just a moment where things just pivot a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, he does different things with, what, 157 different sonnets. He does different things, but one typical way he'll... the first four lines will get you into the situation. The next four lines will deepen, maybe slightly change, and then there'll be a little turn. And sometimes he's arguing with somebody who isn't really there. He's arguing with convention sometimes, or he's enraged and arguing with himself or with this lover who's, you know, not behaving as he wants.
Do you have a favorite sonnet or one that you return to again and again that gives you delight?
I do. I love so much the sonnet that begins, "When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes." Essentially is, when I'm miserable, when I'm alone, when I'm down, I think of you, and that makes everything much better. I wouldn't even trade my state with kings. I just love that so much.
Yeah. They stick around here with us even today. That's Amy Fuqua. She is Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Black Hills State University. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're closing the show today, spotlighting a joy of learning presentation at Black Hills State University in Spearfish. This one is called, Did Your Mom Throw Your Baseball Cards Away? Steve Meeker is Vice President of University Advancement at Black Hills State. He joined us from our studios on the campus in Spearfish.
Our agenda is to talk about mom, and you know how mothers are, they would not throw you out with the dishwater, and they love you unconditionally, and they would do anything for you. It's just that mom, they like to clean, and part of cleaning sometimes is we don't need this anymore. And so the second part of my agenda when I'm presenting was, let's talk about how wealthy you could have been.
You're right.
Depending on what she threw out, you know. So, and then we cover the history of sports cards and bringing back childhood memories. But yeah, I mean, we're of course having fun with mom,
right.
But we also know that that happened.
There is something about, and I want to get to the cards here in a minute, but there's also, I think, something about adult baseball fans, adult men, for example, who just feel like, oh, that's what could have been. And maybe they didn't really even have the card. Maybe they just had a box.
Yeah.
And they're like, I don't know. I've had a few of those conversations where I'm like, did you really have those cards that you think you had?
You know,
or is that just childhood nostalgia for
you? You might be right, but we're not going to admit that.
Okay, all right. I am a mother, so
yes,
there we
yes.
have it. All right. So, are you a collector too? And how long has that been part of your life?
Yes, I am a collector, and I've been. You know, I did it as a child back in the 70s, basically, and then I took about 20 years off, picked it up in the 80s and 90s. And then, although that's not 20 years if you do the math, but there's, you know, 15 years or whatever in there. And then picked it up here in the last 3 years again, because it took about 20 years off in between the 90s and where we're at today.
Well, the internet must have just absolutely changed the market for sharing, pricing, and buying cards.
Absolutely. Your best bet is selling cards. If you want to sell them, your best bet is to sell them online, definitely.
So tell me a little bit about why these cards were created. Were they designed to be collectibles in the first place? Like, when did baseball card collecting become big business?
You know, the first card that I'm aware of, and I believe it is the first card, was back in 1865, which is right around the Civil War time. And it was, I don't believe it was made for collecting. It was just something that was distributed for people to look at. And that specific card sold in 2013 for around $92,000.
Wow. Who's on the card? Is it a person?
No, it's called the Champions of America, and it's more of a baseball team or a baseball club that's on the card.
When do we start seeing individual players show up on card faces?
Yeah, in the mid-1880s, the tobacco companies started having baseball cards in the pack of smokes. So these cards were smaller than the cards that you see today. But of course, if you today had any of those cards, they're worth a pile. They are very collectible. And there's one in there, Honus Wagner, who is worth millions of dollars. So that's kind of where the individual card started out.
So tobacco company, so then this is not marketed toward children.
That was not. And again, I'm not, you know, I don't think it was necessarily for collecting at that time either. Yeah, it was just kind of, you know, so the actual individual cards that maybe were marketed for kids with gum and those type of things started maybe around the 1930s in that time frame. And then, of course, have evolved to what it is today.
How have the cards itself changed in the fact that, you know, what they put on back of it, stats, like why were the cards important and collectible other than, you know, just money, right? There's a reason for them other than were they tradable? Were they, this is where you got your information about the player?
You know, the information's there, but for me, it was one of two things and still is why I collect. And one would be, you know, who is the player that maybe touches my heart that, you know, if I'm a Minnesota Viking fan, maybe I collect Minnesota Viking cards or Minnesota Twin cards. You know, so you have that side of it. But then, of course, the bigger side is the investment side. Mm-hmm. If you're looking to get into it for that reason, you're looking for rookie cards, and which is the first year of cards for that specific player. And that's where you start really getting into the cash.
Yeah. So then you are, there's a little bit of a skill set that you would tell yourself you have, that you have identified who that rookie is going to be, that someday you're going to wish you had his rookie card, right? Is this, that what makes it fun is what I'm trying to get at. Like what makes collecting fun?
I mean, there's no question I'm a fan of football, baseball, basketball, and I have a good idea of who you should be collecting, what rookie cards are going to be worth something. So the knowledge of sport in general is going to be helpful to you. Although, again, you can go buy a pack of cards, go out online and see what, if you can find that specific card and find the value of it. So you don't necessarily have to know everything.
Steve Meeker is Vice President of University Advancement at Black Hills State University in Spearfish. We will put links up on our website to all of the Joy of Learning presentations so you can find more information about how to attend. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and R. Youngeman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson, and our engineer is Colton Nicholson. I'm your host, Lori Walsh, from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.